Today we're wanting to deal with our history, understanding our history, celebrating some of our Christian heritage, and we should start with Jan van Riebeck, the father of the nation. Although even before Jan van Riebeck, there's Bartholomew Dias. Bartholomew Dias was a Portuguese explorer. He was trying to find a way to the east, and because the Muslims had blocked the trade routes to the east, and therefore they had to come around the Horn of Africa to avoid the Ottoman Empire that now had conquered Constantinople and was blocking the trade routes to the east. As he came around, he was planting crosses. You can see replicas of crosses like these, like if you go down to Cape Point. And he went as far as Mossel Bay. It was Bartholomew Dias who actually named False Bay, False Bay. Not that False Bay is a false bay, it's a real bay. But it was a false hope. He came around thinking, oh, we've reached the southern tip of Africa, we're now on our way up to India, and then, no. And had to come out, and so it was called False Bay. And strange to have that bay called False when it's actually a really top-class, real, genuine bay. 1488, Bartholomew Dias came and sighted the coasts of southern Africa, named False Bay. And you can see we had a 1 rand commemoration from 1488 in 1988 was produced. Different statues, and most prominent right in the foreshore on the reclaimed land, what would have been smack in the middle of Table Bay back in the 1480s, Bartholomew Dias's monument close to the ugly customs house, Table Bay, and our Cape Town International Conference Centre, erected by the Portuguese community in South Africa. Vasco da Gama came past, and while Bartholomew Dias had gone no further than Mossel Bay and then turned back, I think he was getting short of supplies, Bartholomew Dias came out much more prepared, much more well-equipped with more ships, and he went all the way around, and it's Bartholomew Dias who named Natal after the Nativity, because it was sighted on Christmas Day. So we have the Zulu, who their name actually means people of heaven, KwaZulu, the place of the people of heaven. And so KwaZulu-Natal, you've got the Nativity of Christ and the people of heaven joined in the name of that province. Interesting. Yes. Bartholomew Dias went all the way to India, came back, lots of celebrations. He is a great hero, opened the way to the east, although he had based his work, of course, on what Bartholomew Dias had done. Everyone has a part to play. It's like a marathon race where somebody runs a distance, passes the baton to the next one who runs the next distance. We are all in a marathon race, a mountain marathon relay race, actually, in life. And our job as parents is to pass on the baton to the next generation, who's passed on the baton to the next generation. And you can see this in South African history. Bartholomew Dias had his part, so did Vasco da Gama, but interestingly enough, the Portuguese did not settle the Cape. And the reason why they didn't settle the Cape is because they had bad experiences. They came around and said, oh, the weather's terrible, there's storms. They called Cape Town the Cape of Storms, which wasn't good for tourism. It was renamed later Cape of Good Hope. And they looked at South Africa as a very hostile, rocky, unpleasant shores. So they settled Mozambique and Angola, Portuguese West and East Africa. If they had settled South Africa, we could have, like Brazil, a huge Portuguese-speaking Catholic country stretching from Angola and Mozambique all the way through what is today Zimbabwe and Botswana, Lesotho and Swaziland, South Africa, as one big Portuguese Catholic bloc. But just as God had prevented the Spanish from settling North America, they settled in the more pleasant tropical climates of Central and South America, and it was left for the Protestants to 150 years later settle the north of America. And so it was in South Africa that providentially God kept South Africa from being settled by Catholic Portuguese, even though they were the first ones to round here and sight it, just as the Spanish Catholics were the first to sight the New World of the Americas. So we had that God providentially kept the Cape open for the Dutch Protestants and later the British, Scottish and German Protestants to come and settle here. So the key name in this is Johan Anton Zoon van Riebeck, born 21st of April 1619, Culemborg in Netherlands, the son of a surgeon. This is the town where Jan van Riebeck was born. beautiful town of Culemborg. Jan van Riebeek grew up in Schiedam, where he married 19-year-old Maria de la Calier, who is actually Huguenot from France, refugee from the French persecution. Married 28th of March, 1649, Jan and Maria van Riebeek had 8 children. He was involved in the Dutch East India Company. One of their sons, Abraham van Riebeek, was born in Cape Town, later became Governor General of the Dutch East Indies. This a likeness of their son, born in South Africa, Abraham van Riebeek. At age 20, Jan van Riebeek joined the Dutch East India Company, the VOC, served as a surgeon in Batavia in the East Indies, also a surgeon like his father. He was also the head of the Dutch East India trading post in Tonkin, what today is Vietnam. You might recall the name. The Gulf of Tonkin incident was a false flag operation that justified America's involvement, well, meant to justify America's involvement in the Vietnam War. Tonkin, so that famous Gulf of Tonkin. That's where he served. He also served in Dajim in Japan. And Jan van Riebeek proposed the selling of animal hides from South Africa to Japan, where there's a great demand. 1651, he volunteered to establish a Dutch settlement at what became known as Cape Town, Table Bay at that stage. Right here. Not that you would have seen those buildings there at that time, but the mountains would look pretty much the same. He landed 3 ships, the Dromedaris, the Reka, and the Goeie Hoop in Table Bay. And he built the Fort of Good Hope as a halfway house supply station for VOC vessels traveling between Europe and the East Indies. And this is the prayer that Jan van Riebeek prayed on landing in Table Bay, 6th of April, 1652. O gracious and most merciful God and Heavenly Father, in your divine majesty, you have saved us and called us to guide the affairs of the Dutch East India Company in this place. And to this end, we are gathered here today, together in your name. May the decisions we take further maintain justice. And among these wild and uncivilized people, may your true and perfect Christian teachings be established and spread to the honor and praise of your holy name and the prosperity of our God Almighty, without whose merciful help we are powerless. Therefore, we pray to you, most merciful Father, and ask that you will stand by and support us with your fatherly wisdom and understanding and preside over our gathering. Lift our hearts, that all wrong passions, misunderstandings, and bestial lusts be removed from us, and cleanse our hearts. And so fix our minds, that in our actions no other principles or motives and apparent other than the magnification and honor of your most holy names, so that we may best serve our Lord and Master without in any way acting for our own advantage, or taking into account personal gain, to which end we will also carry out our orders and so earn a worthy blessing. We ask and pray this in the name of your beloved Son, our Master and Savior, Jesus Christ, who taught us to pray, Our Father art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, and prayed the full Lord's Prayer. Now, when you look at this prayer, you get something of the humility, the servant heart, the vision, and it's very hard to understand the hostility for Jan van Riebeek in recent times, such as when they had this ANC rally in the Cape Town Stadium and talking about they had a witch doctor there come to exorcise the spirit of Jan van Riebeek from Cape Town. Now, considering Jan van Riebeek didn't die in Cape Town, he's buried in Batavia, actually, out in the Far East. So what does the spirit of Jan van Riebeek then need to exorcise from Cape Town? The spirit of Christianity. The spirit of a humble, servant-hearted vision of the Great Commission, a desire to honor the Lord. You can see here an appreciation of the depravity of man. You can see here the desire that bestial lusts and selfishness and our own gain be driven from us. This was a Christian attitude of someone who is one of the children of the Reformation. Holland, Netherlands, grew out of tremendous move of the work of the Reformation. And you can see a real spirit of the Puritans amongst the Nederlanders in the 1600s here. So when people want to rant and rave and scream about Jan van Riebeek and want to banish the spirit of Jan van Riebeek from Cape Town, the only spirit I can think they're talking about is actually the Holy Spirit. So what did he actually do? In fact, lest we miss the point, because today there's a lot of nonsense being spoken about our history, which we need to counter. There are those who say, well, the whites stole the land. Well, honestly, I think they're missing the whole story here. Because first of all, we have got a huge amount of evidence in the way of cave paintings, rock art, and so on, that the Khoisan, the Hottentots and Bushmen, had a civilization all over West Africa, all the way down. So you've got from Kenya all the way down through what today would be Tanzania, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, evidence that the Khoisan lived all the way there. And as the Bantu tribes moved from what is mostly West Africa and Ethiopia area down, they exterminated the Khoisan and totally exterminated them all the way down until in the 1770s, when the Bantu downward settlers, if you want to use that word, or colonialists, if you want to use that word, or invaders, if you want to use that word, finally met the white settlers who were moving northwards. And the only reason Khoisan, Hottentot, or Bushman descendants survive in the Cape is because they were protected by the white settlers, the Dutch and English settlers here, from the Bantu, who hunted them out as like animals. They literally hunted them, just like we've heard that some Australians hunted Aborigines for sport. Well, the black nations hunted the Khoisan for sport and killed them or enslaved them, just as they are doing even to the pygmies to this day in the Congo. And this is notable because from the first frontier war between the Khoisa and the farmers in the eastern frontier, which started in the late 1700s, from the first time, the Khoisan and the Bushmen always joined with the white farmers in fighting against the Khoisa. And they were immediately the allies. So when Thabo Mbeki comes along with his that the Hottentots and the what he calls the San people, the Khoisan people, were the brothers and neighbors of the Bantu, the black people. Well, that's not historically true. That's not the way the Khoisan saw it, and it's certainly not the way the Khoisa saw it. They always were enemies, more than enemies. In fact, the evidence is that all the Khoisan civilizations in all of Africa were wiped out, and the only ones to survive are the ones under the protection of the white settlers here in the southern tip of Africa. Khoisan lived a simple, nomadic life, continually on the move. And when Jan van Riebeck and the Dutch settlers arrived, they found the Khoisan people, who are not black people, but brown, more Aboriginal. The Khoisan are not regarded by the black people as their own people. They're not Bantu. The outpost established in Table Bay by Jan van Riebeck initially consisted of just 82 men and 8 women. During the first winter at the Cape, 19 people died in a harsh environment. Now, you may not think Cape Town's a harsh environment, but take away our houses, shopping malls, and all the electricity, plumbing, and everything else. This is not a hospitable part of the world, actually. These people had to build fast and furiously in order to just survive the winter. Within a few months of arriving in the Cape, the Dutch Republic and England became engaged in a naval war because of merchant trade. It was totally unnecessary. In fact, Oliver Cromwell was busy fighting the Irish Catholics at that moment. And when he came back, he was horrified that Protestant England was fighting Protestant Netherlands. And it was one of the things that led him to purge parliaments, kick out the Presbyterians who were on waging a war against the Dutch. And he immediately stopped the war with the Netherlands because he wanted all Protestant nations to work together. But nevertheless, because the Dutch and the British navies were involved in this brutal war over nothing other than competition in merchants' fleets, the completion of a fort in the Cape became of the highest urgency, and the Fort de Goede Hoop was hastily built of mud, timber, clay, in the middle of what is today Adley Street. In fact, you can see here was the fort. Fort is a four-pointed fort. It had four bastions, and they had areas built around the front and the back in order to receive, to have the livestock and the horses. So you can see where our present-day castle is, the five-pointed star, versus next to Adley Street. Here's Adley Street, basically. The fort of the VOC, which is now basically buried under, well, it wasn't made of very long-term type material. So the Fort of Good Hope didn't last very long. The castle was built later, 1666. So Cape Town became the most valuable strategic naval base in all of Africa and all of the Southern Hemisphere, right from the beginning. And this was the jewel of the crown of the Dutch East India Company, and they wanted to protect it. Notice the background painting is quite accurate for the mountain. Not always. Sometimes you think those artists must have been doing it from memory, because some of them are not that accurate. And here, a rebuilt example of the dromedaris. So the Dutch flag, big and bold, flying over these vessels. Netherlands was one of the greatest sea powers in the world, bearing in mind that before 1588, before the Spanish Armada was destroyed in its attempt to invade England. And one should remember that it was not only the English who defeated the Spanish Armada, but the Dutch as well. The Dutch had a very key role in it as well, because most of the invasion army were going to come from the Duke of Parma, from the Netherlands, in barges across and up the Thames as part of the invasion of England. And it was the Dutch freedom fighters, under the leadership of people who would have followed Prince William of Orange, that made it possible for the Armada to be defeated too. So the Netherlands and England were two great Protestant powers who rose as naval powers to challenge the Spanish and the Portuguese, who had been the naval superpowers in the past. And that's important, because before the rise of the Netherlands and England as naval powers, missions overseas was virtually impossible. John Calvin sent missionaries as far as Iceland and Finland and Brazil. But all the missionaries he sent to Brazil were killed upon landing. They were discovered almost immediately by the Portuguese, and they killed them all, executed every last one. So there wasn't one Protestant missionary who went to Brazil that survived in the days of John Calvin. John Calvin and his academy sent out over 2,000 missionaries who went mostly to France, but they also spread to other parts of Europe and as far as Brazil. But missions overseas was impossible while the Catholic superpowers of Spain and Portugal dominate the seas. Only with the defeat of the Spanish Armada and with the rise of England and the Netherlands as great naval powers did missions overseas become a possibility. Can anyone give me the date when the Netherlands finally achieved its independence from Spain? Because Netherlands was a colony of Spain until what date? When did the Netherlands finally achieve its independence? I'll give you a clue. Peace of Westphalia. Date? 1648. So 1648, the Netherlands finally achieved its independence, recognized by treaty. Of course, been fighting for a long time before that. But that was when it was finally internationally recognized. Netherlands is no longer a colony of Spain. It's now an independent country, 4 years before Jan van Riebeek was sent to the Cape. So these people who talk about, you know, Dutch colonialists, I don't think they understand that the Dutch were fighting for freedom from vicious Spanish Inquisition for centuries. And the Nederland freedom fighters under, for example, Prince William of Orange, were absolutely tenacious, and like the Siege of Leyden, in order to chase the Spanish out, who were besieging and destroying their land, Prince William of Orange ordered, break the dikes, flood the land. We can rebuild the dikes and drain the land later, but first we've got to get rid of the Inquisition, the Spanish. Great freedom fighters indeed. But Cape Town was the furthest flung, most southernmost point naval power projection of the Netherlands. And of course, England, being what should have been its Protestant ally, unfortunately sometimes was its Protestant competitor and enemy. And so they had to build a strong defensive fortification in the Cape in order to prevent the British seizing this most coveted naval station. And so here you can see later on in the 1700s, again, you wonder if the person who drew this was actually here, or it was from memory. By the way, can you tell what church that is with this tall steeple? No, that's long before St. George's. The oldest Protestant church in the Southern Hemisphere still standing and still operational. It's the Lutheran Church. Strand Street Lutheran Church. And that's still there. It was built in the 1770s. So that dates this picture. This picture's got to be late 1700s, just before the British invaded. So this is part of the story of the Cape. Let's go back to Jan van Riebeeck. For 10 years, Jan van Riebeeck served as commander of the Cape, 1652, 1662. He planted vegetable and fruit gardens. He imported livestock to provide fresh stocks of fruit, vegetables, meat and milk to vessels passing the Cape to combat scurvy, which, of course, people on sea for months on end could easily contract. Many of the innovations of Jan van Riebeeck changed the natural environments of the Cape forever, including importing grapes, cereals, groundnuts, potatoes, apples, citrus trees. None of this is indigenous here. When people get hysterical about we've got to chop down the pine trees and so on, they're not indigenous to the Cape. Well, neither's mealie-meal, neither's vineyards. In fact, oak trees are not indigenous to England. You know that the Romans brought oak trees to England in the time of Caesar, 2,000 years ago. Is there anyone to say, let's uproot all oak trees from England, they're not indigenous? Rubber trees are not indigenous to Malaya. Coffee is not indigenous to Brazil. In fact, all the coffee in the world comes from Ethiopia originally. And the reason why there are coffee plantations anywhere else in the world is mainly because in the 1500s, when the Abyssinians were being besieged by the Muslims and about to be overthrown, the Portuguese sent some crusaders to help the Abyssinians defeat the Muslims. And one of the rewards was they were given coffee trees, which they took to Brazil, which, of course, they were settling then. So when people talk about it's not indigenous, well, the Xhosa aren't indigenous to the Cape either. The ANC and socialism isn't indigenous to the Cape. Neither are cell phones. And you could carry on through a whole range of things. This business of let's chop down all the trees because we don't think they're indigenous. We've had millions of trees chopped down in the Western Cape since 1994. And drought is one of the consequences of deforestation. At any rate, you could see where the castle was, the Five Points Castle. Notice the rivers. Now, many of these rivers that you see depicted here, you think, where are these rivers now? We've got underground springs of pure mountain water, drinking water that you could bottle and sell in the shops. Millions of gallons of them pouring into the ocean every day without being used, just because they've got massive underground river systems which have been paved over. They're basically in drainage systems under the city. One of the biggest underwater lakes is under our parliament itself, totally unused, untapped, draining into Table Bay Harbour every day because we've, of course, paved over so much of it. Now, there have been those who've identified 36 natural springs in the Table Basin under in front of Table Mountain, what is correctly Cape Town. This is Cape Town, place between Table Mountain and Table Bay. Where we are now is not Cape Town, or at least not when I was growing up. This is Rondebosch. This is, by the way, the first settlement after Cape Town. They called it Liesbeek Valley at the time. And they were really settling here in the 1660s. So what you used to have is Cape Town, Camps Bay, Sea Point, all the way through, which is now more like Seapoo Point, and you all the way out to Brackenfell and so on. Those are all different towns. The Uni City is an ANC creation, one of the worst things Mandela ever did, where instead of lots of efficient, accountable communities where the mayor and town councillor are answerable to the local people and their neighbours, now you've got a uni city where they don't know and don't care. And it's just one big cover for corruption. The whole city's being looted. But we've got more than enough water flowing from Table Mountain, most of it in underground rivers now because it's all been paved over. And so a lot of our problems are, well, not just deforestation, but we'll get there just now. Now you can start to get a bit of an idea on how they are settling from the Fort of Good Hope and other little forts put out, and they start to get blockhouses on what we'd call Devil's Peak area as well, and farms coming along, including around Liesbeek Parkway and where we are right now. And Cape Town's getting built up, and you can see these green things are the gardens. In fact, they're still the gardens. You can walk around there today, just up from Parliament and St. George's Cathedral. And you can see quite a lot of the original trees planted and vineyards and so on, all designed to provide food for the passing ships to the east. And again, you've got some of the early... I don't know if you can see this easily. Can you see we've actually got canals? They had canals all over Cape Town. Of course, the Dutch people love canals, so used to be traveling around in barges and canals in Cape Town, almost like a Venice thing. And the British laid just bricked it all up, and a lot of that natural water is flowing into Table Bay underneath our feet without being used at all. In Kirstenbosch National Botanical Gardens, you can still see some of the wild almond trees that he planted in order to keep cattle thieves out. And this is, you can go there and see Van Riebeck's hedge. There's some of the wild almond tree bushes, hedge that grew very effectively in order to keep the people who wanted to steal the stock of our settlers. And these are all just examples of what was brought here by Jan van Riebeck. His diary showed a keen eye for the environment, for natural resources, and understanding of the culture of the bushman hunters and the Hottentot or Khoikhoi herdsmen in the area. And on 17 December 1652, Jan van Riebeck reported the first comet sighting from South Africa, or from the Southern Hemisphere even. Shortly after being relocated to the Dutch East India Company, his wife Maria died in Malacca, now part of Malaysia, 2nd November 1664. She was only 35 years old. Jan van Riebeck died in 1677 in Batavia in what is today called Jakarta, on the island of Java. Again, I don't think these things are known by Zuma and his witch doctor that he had casting the spirit of Jan van Riebeck out at this stadium rally a while ago. Here's Batavia. Again, you can see a similar design of type of forts that the Dutch used here, with overlapping fields of fire and all of that in Batavia. And the same kind of neat grid system of setting out a town like they did here in South Africa. But this is Batavia, very similar to what they did here. For many years, Jan van Riebeck was recognized as the father of the nation. His image appeared in our stamps and currency from 1940s until 1993. Notice here, Southwest Africa postage stamp as well. That reminds us when 1 penny used to be a standard postage stamp. When our mission started, our first postings were 4 cents stamps for average one. We could send 5 kilograms of books overseas to America or Britain for 4 rand postage, book post. The coat of arms of the city of Cape Town is based on the Van Riebeck family coat of arms. So here you've got Cape Town's always been symbolized by a woman holding an anchor, but the Jan van Riebeck symbol of the three circles in the, like here on the shield, that's Jan van Riebeck's. So this is again showing Cape Town's link to Jan van Riebeck. In 1977, at the 325th anniversary of the arrival of Jan van Riebeck, and was celebrated with all kinds of special stamps, and you can see again at the tercentenary, that's in 1952, then it was 2 pence for a postage stamp. Again, here you've got another one. This would have been overseas postage stamp, 2 pennies. 1 penny is for internal postage stamps. All kinds of Jan van Riebeck and Maria van Riebeck postage stamps, and also Dutch East India Company, the money as well. I remember our, 10 shillings and then became 1 rand notes. These had Jan van Riebeck's image on it. This, by the way, is back in the days when, do you know, 1 rand, when I was growing up, could buy more than what 500 rand can buy today. So how's that for debasing people's currency? That is theft. We've had an economist here, Stephen Midford Goodson, who was in fact the director of the Southern Reserve Bank for many years. He has written books on the history of central banking and enslavement of mankind. He says prices don't increase. Money gets debased. A gold coin, a 1 ounce gold coin 2,000 years ago could buy a toga, leather sandals, and a belt for 1 gold coin. And today, a suit and with shoes and so on will cost you about 1 gold coin as well. He said the price of things When you say the cost of living's increasing, actually it's not the cost of living that's increasing, it's the money that's being debased, that they're devaluing the currency, which is a hidden tax, which is theft. If people understood how much is being stolen from us by government corruption and by banksters and inflation, forget everything else. It's a distraction from the main thing, which is most of the theft taking place in the world today is through inflation. It's a hidden tax by which governments confiscate your earnings, your pensions, your everything, basically. So much so that a person who worked hard their whole life and now has a pension, they could be destitute like in Zimbabwe because the money's worthless. And they have to sell their home that they owned because they can't afford to pay all the property taxes and rates and taxes, which is, since when can a government tax your property? It's forbidden in the scriptures. But this is back when we actually had real money, just to remind us of how money used to look. And South Ganavi, acknowledging the original ships, Jan van Riebeck, we had the SS Jan van Riebeck, and remembering the first man and first lady of South Africa, originally the father and mother of the nation. And you see this penny with the two sparrows. That was the first act of union of South Africa, proposed by President Marius Steyn of the Free State. He wanted two sparrows on it, reminding us of the scripture that said, are not two sparrows sold for a single coin, yet your father cares for each of them, showing that God cares about the very least. It's a pity that our 1 cent coins are not being used anymore, again, because of debasing of the currency. But you can see, Jan van Riebeck's image was pervasive everywhere. And the fact that he's been now banished somehow out of the media. It was the Springbok and Jan van Riebeck and his wife and the VOC. And you can see some of the medals. This on the tercentenary of the founding of Cape Town. And a lot of artwork, coins. Towns such as Riebeck Castile and Riebeck West and schools such as Hoër Skool Jan van Riebeck are also named after founding father of South Africa. Isn't this interesting seeing what it used to look like at the foreshore? At the tercentenary of the arrival of Jan van Riebeck, Van Riebeck Day was declared a public holiday, 6th of April, 1952. And here the people marching down Adderley Street with big VOC flags dressed in the attire of the era. Later it was renamed Founders Day, 6th of April. The date he landed in Table Bay was observed as national holiday until 1994. Gee, see how green everything was. The wife of the governor, Maria de la Crillière, is the first French Huguenot to have moved to South Africa. And she's born the daughter of Abraham de la Crillière and Maria de Boy, described as energetic, thoughtful hostess, gifted diplomatic. She's well-respected and liked in the colony. Brave woman to come to uttermost parts of earth, to a wild, savage, unknown country at the edge of the earth where there was no infrastructure. There's a statue of Maria van Riebeck at the foreshore on Adderley Street in Cape Town. And here you can see Jan van Riebeck's statue, Maria van Riebeck's statue on this side, in front of the fountains, when the fountains still worked. The South African Navy was also naming one of their submarines, the SAS Maria van Riebeck, in honor of her as the mother of the nation. And I know people in the southern Rekis who were deployed into Angola or brought back from Angola by the Maria van Riebeck. In fact, there was a time in our country's history when we just had this terrible escalation, 1988. They had artillery bombarded and a base near Ruakana, and we lost, was it 11 men in one day's action? And there was counteractions being organized. Well, Maria van Riebeck managed to get through all the booms and security into Luanda Harbor and I sat and spoke to the captain in Walvis Bay base about this shortly after, and he was really irate. He had Cuban warships in his sights. Now, the Cubans had just killed some of our men. We wanted retaliation. He asked for permission to fire, and he could have sunk a couple of Cuban warships in the harbor, you know, sort of like what the Brits did to the Belgrado and Falklands War as retaliation. And word came back from Pretoria, no. And he had to come out And why? We were at war. They were allowed to attack us, and we weren't allowed to counter them. So there was treachery going on even at that stage. Lovely submarine, Maria von Rieburg. And we've got this being commemorated, the Jan van Riebeck ship as well. This was the Jan van Riebeck, one of our frigates. Now, this was a day when we didn't have much out at the foreshore. How things have changed. Now they're building up quite a lot more. Jan van Riebeck's getting hemmed in by tall buildings. But all the same, you know that history is important because the communists want to remove this symbol. So, there's a lot one can say about Jan van Riebeck. Of course, we're dealing with history today. We've got a lot of resources online and books next door. But let me just point out a few things about the castle. This represents the most advanced technology of defense of the day. Overlapping fields of fire. You couldn't be scaling or trying to take one bastion without another bastion bringing you under fire. Very, very well designed. Extremely effective. You can see the castle's here, and this is now where the railway station is, and you can keep going on. It's extraordinary how many millions of tons of soil has been moved into Table Bay to extend into the... Isn't it funny? We've got all of Africa behind us, and the Dutch sense of reclaiming land, even here in Cape Town, we had to still reclaim land. So, who can name the five bastions of the castle? The first, the tallest... Leerdam. And over here, that would be Katzen Ellenborken, I think. And we've got Buren, Nassau, and Aranje. I think that's Aranje. Here we go. Okay, Leerdam, Buren, Katzen Ellenborken's where the jail is, Nassau the furthest out, Aranje, the five bastions of the castle. The British filled in the moat, but in 1980, a friend of mine, 1980s, who's a Captain Coughlin, he became Commandant Coughlin, he started the refurbishing of the castle in order to bring it back to the way it was in the Dutch days, including putting at least parts of the moat in. Some of the lions, some of the original cannons, this would be an 18-pounder, I think. The entrance to the castle, you notice, well, we'll look at that earlier. We used to have all the flags that's Cape Town been under. The old Dutch flag, notice with the orange, white, and blue. And then the Union Jack, when the British took over here in 1795 during the French Revolution, when the French took Holland, the Dutch people asked, could you please free the Cape before the French get it? Notice the original Union Jack did not have the red X in it. It was the St. George's Cross of England, red on white, and then the St. Andrew's Cross of Scotland, that's the white X on blue. But then they added the St. David's Cross representing Wales after 1805. So from 1600s, when, I think from 1603, when King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England and of the United Kingdom. But then later, when they recognized Wales as well, so from the 1800s, they used this flag. If you see an American War of Independence picture where they depict this later 1800s British flag, it's ahistoric. There was no such thing as the red X in the Union Jack. That's the old Union Jack that they would have had all the way through 1700s. It's only in the 1800s that the Union Jack added the red X as well. And so the Dutch flag under the Batavians was now red, white, and blue, not orange, white, and blue, depicted in the South African flag. Sadly, today you don't get these flags up at the castle because some half-wits in the ANC objected to having colonial flags. It's a historic monument. It's a museum. That's part of history. But anyway, that's just indication of the kind of mentality we have out there. People who are so fragile they can't handle history. Snowflakes. Table Mountain, I should say, the castle is the original address in Cape Town. You know what the address is? It's Private Bag 1, Cape Town, 8,000. So, the Castle of Good Hope started in 1666 and completed in 1679. This was the original entrance of the castle, but it literally looked out to the ocean, but the ocean kept coming in. so they built a new entrance on this side, not facing seaward, but facing landward. They've got a massive bell that comes from Holland up top there. You wouldn't have been able to take this castle in battle. In fact, it never was taken in battle. Notice the crest of the royal family, of the Netherlands, Prince of Orange, the House of Orange. So you've got the lion with arrows in his hand representing different provinces, the crown, of course. And then you've got the six shields for the six main economic commercial centres and the VOC on each side. Now, again, when the British took over the Cape, they didn't hack off the Dutch emblems because that's part of the history. You wouldn't want to ram your shoulder against this door. Here you can see that the castle wasn't just the castle, but it also had outer defences, such as defence in depth. If you got over the first wall, good for you, but you weren't getting any further. Now you're in a kill zone, no cover, and there's a higher wall, and all I need to do is lob mortars and roll grenades down on you. This is a very well-built, massive structure. Nassau, Oranje, Leerdam, and Katzen, Ellenborg, and here you can see the flags very clearly. Except, spot the mistake. Somebody's put the 1600s British flag in the wrong place. So there's always somebody who doesn't know his flags very well, sadly. It's hard to visit the castle without wanting to ring the bell. My children have done it all at some stage or another. Notice they've got also the showing again some of the pagan mythology. You've got Poseidon on the right and Neptune on the left. Why? Because Cape Town is on the tavern of the seas. We dominate the oceans. And you've got also drums and spices and flags and all sorts of things, fruit, symbolizing trading station. So that's over the entrance on the inside of the castle. This, the cut where the governor would have made his speeches, announcements on, this has been used in many, many, many movies. You see it in, for example, that English woman on Emily Hobhouse. Interestingly enough, in the recent The Crown series on Queen Elizabeth II, when she goes to Ghana, she drives in to the castle, and all this is taking place with Kwame Nkrumah is right here, as though they would have had a 1600 fortress in a place that was only settled in the 1800s, but never mind. It makes a nice backdrop for quite a lot of films. And sometimes they have a passing of the guard, although the quality of the guards has deteriorated. The highest point in the castle here was for what would they have called him? He was in charge of the harbour master. And he could have seen any ship in the harbour, have they paid their dues and whatever. Up these stairs is the entrance to the commandant's office. Now, the commandant's office, this was the commandant's office even in my lifetime. When I was in the army, I was called up once and marched up these stairs to meet the commandant, specifically because they wanted to find out, Hammond, what the hell are you up to? What are you doing in communist countries like Zimbabwe and Mozambique and going into communist terrorist camps and showing the Jesus film, sir? And I was doing all kinds of wild evangelism. So back in 1986, they drummed me up. Then there was a colonel for military intelligence and a whole lot of others who interrogated me to find out, what are you up to? Are you a commie booty? Words to that effect. Because of the funny, strange, weird things I was doing. I mean, we were at war, and I was a Citizens Force soldier who could be called up at short notice, which they did, to just find out. But they wanted me in uniform in the office to answer the questions. They didn't want me in there as a civilian. The most famous person to be Commandant General of the Cape would be? Who would you say is the most famous Commandant General to ever sit in that office? General Charles Gordon. The same General Charles Gordon who freed most of the slaves in Sudan, who died bravely in 1885 in, if you've seen the film Khartoum with Charlton Heston in the lead role, fighting the Mahdi to defend the Sudanese people from the Mahdi's lunatics. Well, Charles Gordon, he made his fame in Crimean War and in China, fighting with the everlasting victorious army, fighting the Taiping rebels. He came and ended the slave trade in Sudan, did major things. Then he was sent as Commandant General of Cape, but he was probably the most unpopular Commandant General of the Cape ever. He was here at the time of the Anglo-Zulu War and the Anglo-Boer War, First Anglo-Boer War, and he took the side of the Zulus and the British. He said, Zulus and the Boers, and he said, the Zulus didn't attack us, we attacked them, the Boers mind their own business, we shouldn't be attacking them. He had the gospel translated into Zulu and into Netherlands, and he shared the gospel with his Dutch friends and neighbors and with Zulus. The Zulu king was meant to be a prisoner at the castle at the time he was there, and he wouldn't have him confined. He let him wander around the walls at his leisure and had good meals brought to him and chatted to him about the gospel. And Cecil John Rhodes, who was a rising star at the time, said, Charles Gordon is the most frustrating person. He's the only person I've ever met who's totally disinterested in money. In other words, he's incorruptible. So they basically got rid of him because he was causing nothing but havoc for the British purposes in the Cape. And then he took a 14-month sabbatical. He went to the Holy Land, to Palestine, which is under Turks, and he did Bible studies and he did excavations, and he identified what's known as Gordon's Tomb, or we know it as the Garden Tomb, and what they call Gordon's Calvary. Now, it's not Gordon's Calvary or Gordon's Tomb, it's just as he identified it. The Catholics and Orthodox for centuries have been going to some places identified by a mystic who had a dream. This is where Christ died, this is where he's buried. And the Catholics and Orthodox built massive superstitious edifices of nonsense over there, and that's where all the people go and light their candles on. But how wonderful that was left up to a previous Commandant General of the Cape to identify where Protestants go, which is in accordance with scriptural and archaeological evidence. At any rate, just an interesting anecdote. And yes, shame. Not the way you should march. But anyway, this is when they used to have grass and lawn at the castle. Notice the sundial. The view from the castle of the the moat. And shamefully, they've allowed so much else to encroach around the castle. But this used to be ocean, lapping up here. And there would have been the door. Yes, there we go. That would have been the entrance to the castle originally. They had to brick it up. Very substantial castle. Very spectacular. This cross comes from Delville Wood, Battle of the Somme, where a South African division got annihilated. Something like 2,500 marched in and only a couple of hundred marched out. And they had to take a salient. That's a place where deep in, well, they took the area they were meant to get, Delville Wood, but the French and British on each side didn't do their part, and so they were actually able to be wiped out from three sides. That's a salient. When you like a knife inside enemy territory. And above here is a description of the noonday gun. You know how the noonday gun began. You all know about the most famous dog in South African history, Jock of the Bushveld. Well, Just Nuisance would be the most famous dog in Cape Town. But in South Africa, Jock of the Bushveld. Well, Jock of the Bushveld's owner, or pet, as the case may be, Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, had proposed to the king of England that they follow Cape Town's example. Cape Town had already started in 1917 having a noonday gun to remind you when noonday gun sounded. It wasn't just to set your watches. It was to pray for 3 minutes. 1 minute for the remember the people who've died. 1 minute to remember to thank God for those who survived, and then to pray for those who left behind. And later it was abbreviated to 2 minutes as the war ended. And when he described this to King George V, King George V sent out an empire-wide instruction in 1919, the first anniversary of the signing of the peace, the armistice, 11th of 11th, 1918. And so empire-wide, everyone was ordered to stop and to pray for 2 minutes. Cape Town has continued it. Most people, I think, have forgotten that the noonday gun is primarily a call to prayer. At noonday. So, lots more. Oak made from Delville Wood. I will get on to Lady Anne Barnard later. Any questions?
just in terms of the political debate at the moment about original people living here, so are we saying that the Khoisan were the original inhabitants all the way up to Kenya, basically?
That is correct.
And
they were completely and utterly exterminated, and the only survivors are those who were able to be protected by the settlers in the Cape.
And at that time, black tribes were only further north?
Yes, originally, I mean, everyone knows this, this isn't exactly something controversial. All the blacks in Africa come from the north. The south was uninhabited, and they were settlers coming from the north as we were settlers coming from the south from the sea. Yes, that is correct. Okay. That shouldn't be controversial, but in days of political correctness, truth does not fear investigation, though. Yes?
How do we know the Khoisan was murdered by the Bantus? Do we have what evidence?
We do. First of all, there's evidence of their type of pottery, type of the rock paintings, most famously. They're unique rock paintings. You're getting all the way from Kenya, Tanzania, all the way down. So we know that they were there, and none of them survived. Now, of course, some would have been moving south as well, and into here, but there would have always been those who stayed behind. You never get everyone moving. So the written records only started with the coming of the Christian settlers from Europe. The tribes in Africa didn't have a written language, with the exception of the Abyssinians. But Abyssinia was unique, but they had already been affected by Hebrew culture from King Solomon and all of that, so that's why they had a written language. But there was nothing resembling that in the rest of Africa. But from the rock paintings, from the pottery, from the weapons and all that, they know the Khoisan were the dominant culture through the whole of East Africa before the Bantu tribes used to move in there.
Could it have been from a drought or natural causes like an epidemic or something?
No, it couldn't have been. They ended up in the most drought-stricken area in the Karoo and the Kalahari. Khoisan can survive in very, very arid conditions. Probably out of necessity, because they had to get away from the stronger armed, bigger, more numerous tribes that were effectively exterminating them. We know that that's what happened to many tribes. It's documented that 156 tribes were exterminated by the Mifakan or Difakan under Dingaan and under Shaka, Mzilikazi, and Dingaan. And so that's between 2 to 3 million black people in South Africa area alone were exterminated in something like 12 years. That's just from about 1816 up to about 1828. And that was just before the Great Trek. So that's why the Trekkers were moving into depopulated territories in what today is the Free State and Transvaal. That they were moving into territory that had been completely decimated. Yes?
You know, I mean, we mostly homeschoolers here. And
yes.
It's actually, I don't know, I'm just sitting here with huge question marks and puzzles and
good
stuff like that, because on the one hand, I mean, the only thing is we want to teach the truth, right?
Yes.
But it's almost like there's a limit to that, because we've been bombarded by what is happening in society, stories that have been passed on now and have been spoken about through the generations. It's almost like there isn't one story that we can tell our kids.
No, in fact,
know, because I mean, at the moment
fact,
now,
we should always
just
be
going through some of the books, and it's the white people are the bad people. They're actually from the devil.
Evil.
They're evil. They came here and they destroyed the whole of Cape Town's people. They drove them. They killed them, and that's it. And they took over. They just took over. You know, that's being portrayed.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And you know, I would have believed some of this at one stage too. But as a missionary, I've travelled very widely. And I've travelled in 37 countries. The last 36 years, and reading, talking, I mean, I thought when I was brought up, well, black people are poor in South Africa because of apartheid.
Yeah.
But then I travelled to Mozambique and all the way up to Congo, all the way up to Nigeria, so I discovered, well, why are they poorer everywhere else?
Yes.
And why do they all want to move to South Africa? And even in apartheid South Africa, black people are moving here by the hundreds of thousands, even today. I mean, nobody was climbing over the Berlin Wall east, trying to get to communism. Nobody is trying to swim to Cuba. People don't flee to oppression. People flee away from oppression. An amazing thing is, even when South Africa was apparently the worst place on earth for black people, all the black people of Africa wanted to come here. And they were coming here. So we know that there's lies that are told. And I found that actually the worst racists are the ones screaming racism all the time, mm-hmm. and the biggest thieves are the ones claiming someone else stole from them. And there's a lot of hypocrisy. In fact, the Bible talks about those who call light darkness and darkness lighting. I think what we've got is an inversion of reality.
Yes.
To slander these Christian people who came with the best of intentions to, and you can see they trebled the life expectancy of the inhabitants. I mean, how oppressive is that?
I just comment on what this lady said. I don't know, we've been studying Footprints on Our Land.
Yeah.
And I think that that course, homeschooling course, gives a very, very balanced view. The books are absolutely excellent. The stories that you read to the children are living books and stories that I never grew up with. So I have learned so much about South African history that I didn't learn in the way that we were taught at school.
Exactly.
highly, highly recommend if you want a more balanced view. So what Footprints has done, it's kind of given living books from the Khoisan. It will start with a book of a little Khoisan boy, so you can identify with him and what he felt like when these white settlers arrived. Then it will be another book from the early settlers, and it just gives, and then there's a book on Shaka, you know, with the black community and how they felt, and then the next book is written from the fur trackers' point of view. So you actually get, you feel sympathetic towards all sides as you're doing the course. And I find that excellent to give my children a balanced view of the history of South Africa. So I would highly recommend doing Footprints.
I think it's so important to know, the best way to learn is, I think, character studies, biographies, looking at individuals and learning their story. And so that's important. So, for example, when I've been out in KwaZulu and we've run courses there, we've often gone on one day, to Blood River, Isimane, Rooikstrift, and I've got Zulu, Boer and Brit people with me, and we go to a Boer victory, a Zulu victory, a British victory, and it was interesting to see how the Christian Zulus, British and Afrikaans descendants, could all unite in prayer at each place and singing and identifying, and the fact is, yes, sometimes my ancestors were on the wrong side, like an Anglo-Boer War. It's a fact. And there's no point trying to defend what the British did in the Anglo-Boer War. It was wicked. It was just about gold and greed. And the farmers were minding their own business, and this was wrong. And just like General Charles Gordon could say, we've got no business invading Zululand. We've got no business annexing the Transvaal and fighting Boers. And so, okay, you can get in trouble with your own people if you can be sympathetic to others, but we look at things from a very different perspective, because we're not looking at it so much as white or English or German or whatever. We look at it as Christians. And that means sometimes the Christian cause has been more faithfully followed by this side or that. And sometimes we've been on the wrong side. And it's part of our Christian tradition to be able to admit when we're wrong and repent and move on and be positive. And to see, I've taken my children around all battle sites, museums, monuments, and so on around Africa, as I've been doing missions, and my children know the Zulus and their stories well, and know all the different sites. And I remember my son, now we climb Mount Majuba, and we're at the top there, and my son asking, you know, did we have ancestors on the Boer side? And I said, I'm afraid our guys wear the red coats, but but you know, we're rooting for the Boers on this one because they were right in this battle, and so on. So to me, it's not so much about proving ourselves right. It's letting the scriptures and the facts tell a story. And that's what we've done with the sketches in South African History book. Any other questions? Comments?
Dr. Hammond, I think the most significant thing here to me in all my history reading and through the schooling is that prayer of Jan van Riebeeck. To be honest, I've never heard that.
And it should be somewhere in Dutch. We should be able to find it in the original Dutch.
But that was the most significant thing here, aside from everything else, because that's always, what was the first mission that was sent out to be done? So
yes.
If we are to make disciples, if you think about the core of that prayer, how significant is that? So in everything else, with all the stuff that has happened out there, as you've said, you could be on the wrong side at different times of your life, or whichever way. But what was that foundation? And I think that was, to me, is actually pulling everything together.
Yes.
In all of the history, this is
it's quite it's convicting.
Yeah.
Because how many of our people pray like this. This is not a self-centered prayer. This is a God-glorifying prayer.
Where was it found? How was this
It was recorded. They understood it was significant. So he had to send a full report back to Europe, and he put his whole prayer recorded for them, because this was a significant step.
Yes. I just want to comment as well. In the Fisher Library, I've discovered you can get all three volumes of Jan van Riebeeck's diary in English, translated into English. It's got three volumes and a daily record of every single thing that he wrote and what happened in his time in the Cape, in his 10 years here.
Awesome.
So you could probably find his whole diary in any local library, certainly in Fisher.
That's actually kind of picking up on that, that in the journals that must be out there, does it sort of show that his life reflected this prayer, that it wasn't just words he spoke, but that he actually lived according to, that it was a heart belief, not just words?
Yes. Now, I was brought up in Rhodesia, and I came to Cape Town, was converted here in 1977, and I remember already in the 80s there was a lot of attack on Jan van Riebeeck, and so on. And it seemed every one of our cultural ancestors here, or any Christian of any sort, being attacked. And you'd see anywhere around Easter, did Jesus exist around Christmas? And it's like the media's been trying to attack everything Christian. And I think there's a consistent humanist anti-Christian bias which is coming through, and that's why we need to reclaim our Christian heritage and not let it be rewritten or edited out, censored out by the secular media.